too windy today.
No, it's Thursday.
So am I. Let's go have a drink. Welcome to Brookings Cafe. There's just no telling who might be here today as we venture in to quench our thirst. We call it our Great American Debate. We come to the discussion in the spirit of fairness and an attempt to offer something conclusive. We don't claim to be experts, but we will strive to come to the table prepared to discuss our topic. We are going to extend invitations to those we think may offer an opposing point of view, and in some cases we may extend a challenge to specific people or groups to defend their point of view. Beware we fact-check anything that sounds questionable, and we look dimly on mere opinions that aren't based in knowledge. We are trying to reach some sort of a resolution, something that both sides can settle on as an idea worth promoting.
This week on Discussions at Brookings Cafe, we are talking about racism and other prejudices. Our participants come from diverse backgrounds and points of view, representing most of Brookings, hopefully, with stories of their own to tell, as well as conversation about the NFL players who won't take a knee, the criminal justice system, where prejudice comes from in the first place, and more. This week on Discussions at Brookings Cafe. So we usually start by introducing ourselves. I'm Lee. I'm the host.
I'm Ray.
I'm LaRose Felicity.
I'm Bob.
I'm Gerald.
And I thought we might start with a little bit of a story, a short story, about us as participants, because the stories that we have are our shared experiences in our culture, which is a diverse population. Through them, we understand the culture, ourselves, and each other better. So I thought by just telling you a little bit about myself, might kick things off. I was a half-Jewish child, and this is going to sound very, very strange in this day and age, but in the 50s, the 1950s, a million years ago, that was not a good thing. I couldn't be in the brownies, kids wouldn't play with me, and things of that nature. In addition, my mother, in her wisdom, decided to sit me down in front of the television when all those documentaries were coming out about Hitler's Germany and the extermination of the Jews, and said, this is what they do to Jewish people, big stacks, huge stacks of naked, starved bodies. So while not being part of the brownies isn't the same as the things other people have experienced, I feel even now when I say that I'm Jewish, that I'm coming out of the closet a little bit. It's a little bit scary. And that's about me enough, I think. Anybody else want to chime in? Why they want to be part of this? Or what brought them to the movement?
Well, especially with the current administration, I think being aware of racism and prejudice is very important. It's interesting you mentioned Jewish kids. I grew up on Long Island, which is about half Jewish, at least the area I lived in. And my first year in school was in Catholic school, and I don't remember anything that they taught me there, and that's why I did that year again in a public school. And when I was in the public school, I was surprised that one of the kids actually admitted he was Jewish, and I thought, oh my God, what a horrible thing to admit to. And I can remember not too long later, I brought a friend home, and my parents told me they didn't want me to play with that kid, and when I asked why, they didn't have an answer. Well, his last name was Balloon. He was Jewish, so that's been my experiences with that, with the Jewish thing, anyway.
And you also have been part of the police.
Yeah, I was Alaska State Trooper for 20 years.
I'm sure we'll hear more about that.
Yes.
My name is LaRose, and I am a second-generation member of interracial family. Both of my children, one is black, one is biracial. My mother was in a long-term relationship with an African-American man in the South, in Kentucky, in the 1960s and 1970s. We've experienced everything from not being part of firebombings and riots because our next-door neighbors came and sat on their chair with their shotguns in our store during riots, to being involved in litigation about civil rights issues. I was an attorney, so I did a lot of work involving civil rights. and I've also been a teacher, and my degree from Berkeley is in cross-cultural education, so my expertise is in helping people understand the way to dialogue between those that seem to be other to them and those that are part of the mainstream. And I'm also lesbian.
My name is Gerald, and where I come from Gary, Indiana. You know, I was born in the 90s, in 92, back in 92. You know, around that time, you know, growing up in my life, even though, you know, I was still a baby, but, you know, in my generation, I was growing up hearing a lot of things about different type of, you know, opinions about, you know, interracial colors and people of all, whatever kind of color they are, what maybe a race, what they may be, you know. And from where I come from, I came from Gary, Indiana, where, you know, it was times when I was a kid, I'd have seen, you know, KKK members marching down the streets. And, you know, it came to a point of time, and, you know, this was when I hit about, like, I say 8, 9 years old. You know, that's around the time, it was about the 2000s, that's when, you know, they ended up making an agreement with, you know, the KKK member, telling them that, you know, they have to find a different way to be able to express themselves without people being able to, well, people is not taking it in the wrong direction. You know, they have to be able to express, be able to freely express themselves without bringing harm to their expression or how they're speaking. You know, see, you know, in my life, I learned a lot of things in my life, and the power in the voice. But what we speak up out of our voice is how we're going to react and how we're going to move, how we're going to feel. So, you know, being on this type of topic is a beautiful topic, because people need to be more aware of what's really going on into our environments and our communities that we live in. You know, it's not a, you know, we all look at each other like we different, but how really different are we? You know, we're not really just so much different. You know, we all so much the same.
Way more the same than different. Bob?
I've been involved in civil rights, as you mentioned, since I was a teenager. It happened to be partially, I guess, because I grew up in the environment of Berkeley and Oakland, which was both a little more sophisticated and integrated in ways that made a white kid like me become aware of some of the issues that were going on. And near the university, which became famous as a hotbed for advocacy and protest, one learned things that one didn't necessarily hear when in other parts of California or in other parts of this country. And I guess part of it is early on I realized that it was important to try to educate white people as to, number one, this nation's history. Most white people don't really understand or appreciate the impact of slavery and genocide and all those things, which are very basic to the history of this country. And I, in many ways, have tried to devote my life to fighting racism and to enlightening white people and to work for ways that people can work together for a better and more just and equal society.
Well, thanks. And I think that one of the things that seems to be part of the culture these days, the greater culture, is that, oh, racism was a problem a long time ago, and we're so much better now. I was read across a writing of an eighth grade student, Rise Hardiman Mostow, who was responding to an article in Yes Magazine. And this is a little bit abridged because I don't want to take too much time on it, but it was very moving, I thought, and revealing. It's called A Break from Racism. If I could ask for a special gift, I would ask for racism to end so that I can identify as myself. I would not fear police, and I could have a break. I'm a 13-year-old black girl with big dreams. Racism has a black minority oppressed. Black and beautiful is how I identify. And the racism against me, all black men and women, is unacceptable. I'm defined by my stereotype, and I can't get a well-paying job. My people cross the street in order not to scare anyone. White women clutch their bags when a black male walks by because they're scared they're going to get mugged. I don't want people to be afraid of me. I want them to like me. When I'm in a dangerous situation, I don't want to hesitate to call 911. I don't want to grow up in fear of police because there should be nothing to be afraid of. I want to dial the number and say my problem. I don't want police to solve problems by ending a life or beating someone half to death in response to fear. I should not fear that police will kill me. We kneel during the national anthem to expose police brutality and racism in the United States of America. I should not have to kneel for my rights. I need a break from the racism our, quote, United States have put black people through. Black people have not forgotten what happened to us when cotton became an industry. If racism was abolished, I would be treated fairly. We would forgive what white people did to blacks and not treat them the way they treated us, because nobody should be treated that way. I would be greeted with smiles instead of stares. We would hug a brother instead of shoot one and stay strong in the face of racism. So what really moved me about reading that is that, how old are you in eighth grade? I don't know, 12, something like that. And here she's already living in a way where there's like a blanket of fear and caution around her in this day and age. That seems outrageous. Wondering if anybody wants to chime in about how they're seeing racism and prejudice in this day and age.
Well, Lee, one of the things I would like to address is the issue of police brutality. You know, when we say, well, you know, racism's over now, at this date, as of, I think it was 2016, we had almost exactly the same number of black people, of unarmed black people killed by police, as was the average number of people that were lynched during the Jim Crow era. And, you know, the things that are mentioned in that poem are things that are, they're structural issues of racism. You know, people think about racism as, well, you know, I'm not racist with people. I'm nice to everybody. I have friends. You know, we all get along. But that doesn't say anything about, you know, redlining in certain neighborhoods that makes it so that, you know, people can't get mortgages in areas that are heavily black, which has been a multi-generational problem. And when, you know, we still have difficulties with, you know, it's just very apparent that the lowest earnings people in the United States are black women, followed by white women, followed by black men, followed by white men. It hasn't changed. The issues of income, the issues of and, you know, being able to own a home and pass that down to the next generation is called generational wealth transfer. You can't do that if you don't have the opportunity to buy a home. Yeah. Credit has been denied. You know, we act as if the whole economic impact of slavery and Jim Crow just ended one day, but it hasn't ended. It goes on today, year in and year out, city in and city out. And first, furthermore, you know, Hillary Clinton said in her website that America's schools today have resegregated, and they have. My daughter went to school in San Francisco in a school that was 80% black and brown, and it got that way by busing people from the black areas of town to the black school. You know, we have not ended segregation. Segregation is also brought about by standardized testing, which we know has a two-level disparity between white and black people of the same class. So it's a 20-point differential between white and black people of the same class. So there are elements of the testing that are triggering, you know, misunderstanding, racial issues, and or it's just simply written the same way that literacy tests to vote were written to, you know, to downgrade and to put in a lesser place the black people that are taking the tests.
And it seems to me like the vote is really under attack right now in just those kinds of ways. Literacy tests and needing your identification and all these kinds of things that really are a bias against certain classes of people having the vote.
That's indeed true, and one thing that most white people don't understand about the civil rights movement is how crucial the right to vote was. In the South, there were entire counties of Alabama where not one black person was allowed to vote, and that also meant they would not be allowed to be on juries. And imagine being a black person in Alabama being accused of whatever and having a jury not of your peers, but of the dominant white establishment which controlled the South. And part of the Jim Crow South that made it so awful is the same people who were judges and attorneys and police officers during the daytime to put on the robes of the Klan at night and terrorize black people and also terrorize white people who were bold enough to let it be known how awful the situation was.
Yeah. You were in the police. What did you experience? You were a state trooper, I believe.
Yeah, I lived in Alaska, and I was told once by a black friend of mine that Alaska is a very good place for black people to live. He said it was more accepted than other places he'd lived, and I don't know why. And I think I found that to be true as well. I really did not experience a lot of people making racial remarks. I'm talking about just general population, and in my department there was virtually none at the time that I was a member of it. We had first of all, at the time that I was working there, it was a very sought after job. From what I understand now, police departments are having a hard time hiring people. We had 196 troopers for the whole state, and we would hire about 30 a year, and they would have 1,000 or more applicants. So it was a hard job to get. And then once you did get the job, you went through the academy, which is, like most police academies, a rite of passage, as well as the training. And then you had 96 evaluations by more than a dozen people by the time you finished probation. So you were pretty well vetted by the time you got to where you were out by yourself working on your own, and your job was more or less guaranteed. I can't think of any incidents. The Alaska State Troopers are pretty clean. In recent years, they've had a few scandals, but very few scandals as far as brutality or bad shooting. They've never had a bad shooting, even though the shootings are way up now from what they were when I started, mostly because I assume there's more people carrying guns.
Well, the whole police criminal justice system seems like it's so stacked against any black or persons of color in general.
You know, I'm shocked when I see television now. I see some of the things going on. The Rodney King thing was, of course, a big famous thing, and that was, although I'm not, make it perfectly clear, I'm not defending the action of the LA Police Department, but the news did not handle that very well. As an example, not many people even know there were two people in the car. The one guy just laid down and shut up, did what he was told to do, and Rodney King was actually being very combative. Again, I'm not defending the actions of the police department, but there's been so many things like the deal with the guy was stopped for a broken taillight, and he thought he might have child support, so we ran away, and there's videotape of him running away and the cops shooting at him. After he shoots him, he goes over and plants his taser next to the body. The one in Chicago where the guy is running and bang, 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 bang.
Or the little kid with the toy gun.
Yeah.
There's so many things like that.
Yeah, the Cleveland Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I heard about that incident. Like, how I feel about this police brutality situation, I just feel like, you know, I feel like it's more than a racial thing. I feel like it's more of a mark. They trying to make an example. Like, for a person to, for an officer to want to gun down and record themselves, you know, shooting down a black man, that's more than just a racial interaction. That's more of a setting an example. They more of setting an example to try to say that, look, we do not like you. And if we don't like you, this is what's going to happen. It's more of like when we look up and how we look at these, when we look at the news and we hear about terrorism, how they taking these people from the army and they kidnapping them and posting them on videos and, you know, shooting their heads off and want to view it to the world. I feel like that's what it's more about. I feel like it's more that it's merely more than just an interracial thing. I feel like it's more of a setting a mark, like just like the terrorists try to set a mark to the United States and try to say that, okay, this is what I want y'all to understand, and if y'all don't understand, this is consequence in what's going to happen out of it, you know, if these actions don't amount up. I feel like it's more just being, you know, they want to set their mark, they want to set an example.
I think what you just said explains a little bit more the incident that was been on the in the news the last couple of days, where a basketball player, I don't know the initials.
Walking.
I don't
follow.
NBA, is that okay? Yeah. Anyway, he went into a convenience store at like 2 o'clock in the morning and just casually parked his car over the line, evidently, and part of it was in a handicapped spot. And they showed about five police cars pulling up, red lights going. Why do you have five police cars pulling up to a parking ticket? So I think what you're just said kind of explains that. They're telling that guy, we don't like you here.
And see, another example is because, you know, me being a young man, like, especially being a young African-American, you know, it's even harder. It's even harder in a way that it's not being hard for us to be able to live our lives. It's because they don't want us to live our lives, you know. But I didn't want to be able to build a firm structure of them want to keep their own kind together, you know, and separating us, man, that's the whole moral of it. And by them setting an example, they feel like that's where they're going to reach out. But I feel like this. Me growing up and seeing a lot that I have seen in my life, like, I done been through a lot of racial situations where when I was living in California, I done had people pull up on, like, some white boys pull up on me in a truck and throw gasoline on me and was trying to set me on fire. I had to fight my way. You know, I done had situations like where, you know, when I was in California also, where I done walked in a store, they didn't want to sell me nothing. They told me I had to go. They didn't want, like, how can you refuse to serve me and this is your job? You know, this is what you signed up to do. No matter what race or color you are, if you signed up to be a part of this society and be a part of this type of branch, this is what you signed up for. You know, some people, I feel like they lose sight on what they signed up for, so they bring other excuses into being that reason. That's how I feel like this interracial situation came up out of. It was more of an excuse for them to just flat, instead of them being honest, to say that, oh, well, we don't want y'all or we don't like you. Man, this is what they want to do, making up of an excuse to say, oh, well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to start an interracial thing where we lead everybody in the blind and let everybody attack each other, so now they don't know what the real big picture is going on. See, you got to focus on what's on the inner. See, people don't, they focus on all the big pictures to the point they lose the little picture. And which is that little picture is that little piece of puzzle that people always seem to always lose. You know, anytime you're building up a puzzle, if you're not really clever enough to pay attention and stay aware of all the pieces that you have laying out in front of you, you can easily lose a piece. And when you lose that piece, that's the little picture that you didn't lost or found and which you got to find back, you know. In history, I done seen in a lot of schools growing up in school, you know, I didn't have my chance to graduate. I made it all the way to the 12th grade, but by me not graduating, it was because of a situation I was going through with my family. You know, I never really had my family to fight for me. I never had my mom to fight for her son, you know. I was raised in a house of four of us. You know, I have a twin sister and two brothers. You know, all of them is in the Marines and the Army. And, you know, me, I found a different way of life. And
Do you like the girl I was reading her piece a few minutes ago, like you're constantly having to be like really street smart about your situation?
Yes, and see, you know something, like, you know, when I was growing up, you know, understand as much as I understand that we have to have book smarts into school. You know, what school was built for was mainly for us to learn our history of our timing, for us to have a better way of learning of what the world that we're living in as we get older. You know, that's what school was built for us to have a better, for each generation to have a better understanding of what each generation was going through and how we evolved, you know. And sometimes now that we didn't get it so far in this generation and we done manipulated ourselves so well to believe that, you know, we done lost sight on what our real generation was, what the real origins was, where we really rose from, where we really came from. You know, we really made to believe that this racial situation was going on for generations. It really wasn't. I'm gonna tell you right now, it really wasn't. At one point in time, before we all started attacking each other, man, we all used to get along. But what broke us apart from getting along was because we looked at each other different. When one person was able to get more power than the other, we started looking different upon each other. You know, when I speak, I'm a free will person. Like, I'm spiritual but not religious. You know, because I believe, me being spiritual but not religious, I believe in non-religious as one, because I feel like without a person believing in what they believe in, they wouldn't excel to the highest limit that they excel in it. You know, for me to come as far as I have, you know, it wouldn't ever came from me believing in myself and what I believe in, you know. And I tell everybody all the time, you know, we got to learn how to live in our own emotions. We got to learn how to live in our own ways, you know. Remember what the beautiful times that we have and the beautiful things that we done built, but don't forget how far we done came.
For sure, you know? For sure. I know when you talk about the other, you know, and of course people of color by the color of their skin is always identified as the other, but there's this long history of, you know, every time a new ethnic group comes into the country, the last ethnic group fears for their jobs, and so they start to get very prejudiced against whoever that next group is.
Irish need not apply.
Irish need not apply. And it's been, you know, and then the Italians and this group and that group down through our entire history. And I remember, same person as I am today, but in those days, you know, we were, quote, hippies. We had bell bottoms and we had long hair. And I remember just getting shaken down by the police every time you turned around. You know, so if you cut your hair, then suddenly you're a different person. But it's just a matter of, well, in psychology, they talk about this a lot, that in the way that we identify ourselves is by identify what we are not. Mm-hmm. And then what we are not gets very suppressed and repressed, and all the negative projections are put on them. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be at least part of the paradigm of what's actually going on under the surface. But I don't know what we do about that.
You know, when as I look up, you know, and I see, like, as far as organizations and, you know, gangs and what you call them, mobs and situations like that, like, we didn't look so far into all of these, you know, being in, you know, looking upon, like, us African-Americans being in gangs. You know, I can tell you right now, when African-Americans first started gangs anyway, it originally started in Chicago, Illinois. And I can tell you right now, when gangs was really started, you know, it wasn't called no gangs. It was more of an organization. How we didn't evolve ourselves to, you know, these new generations making up these new little small words saying gang to make it easier for them. No, it was more of an organization. See, a lot of people will be so quick to say the smaller word than to really say the bigger word because they think they're trying to take the easier route, right?
Blackstone but, Rangers.
Exactly. Yeah. You know how, if we really think about it, like how we got like the civil rights movement. If you really think about it, man, the civil rights movement was an organization, but people would look at it as a game because it was only a certain amount of population of people that was moving with this, and there was so many people that was against it. So, what difference is that? You know,
I think one way of looking back at the civil rights experience is realizing that there have been major gains since that time in lots of ways. The black middle class is much bigger than it used to be. When I was growing up, I didn't have a television for a while, but there were really almost no blacks on television. Nat King Cole finally had the first show.
If in the 50s, if you made an appointment with a doctor, say out of the phone book, and you didn't know who he was, and that doctor came in and he was black, you'd be shocked that there was a black doctor, and today you wouldn't think twice about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or a pilot of your 747 or whatever.
And obviously there's been a lot more black presence in the media, in entertainment, in sports. There was even a time when the NBA was basically a white league.
I remember.
You're not that old.
I remember, though.
Remember the history. Anyway.
The history.
And
history don't have an age on it.
I'm going to talk a little personal pride today. I used to teach high school in Oakland, and one of my honor students, Damian Lillard, just was selected to the top 5 All-Stars in the NBA. He was LeBron James and Anthony Davis and James Harden, I believe, and Kevin Durant. And it's a personal and fond example I know of someone who's made it big time. He's also doing well as a rapper known as Dame Dalla. When I went to the 50th anniversary of the Selma March, a USA Today reporter asked me a few things about, well, how was it back in the days and how is it now? There's so many things that seem improvements. It's not uncommon to see interracial couples and lots of different things, but and certainly more presence in media and universities and this and that. But so many things have changed and stayed the same. And in some ways, with the ugliness that's come with Donald Trump, it's gotten a lot worse. Make America Great Again was really a dog whistle to make America white again.
Yeah.
It's not even dog whistling anymore.
It's a nostalgic idea of a society that didn't happen in the way they wanted it to anyway. But it was an ugly time built on people's superiority in their power and in their presence and in their money.
And he's really given people permission to come out and be horrible again.
Yeah, it's...
It's shocking to me how many people have taken that opportunity to be that horrible. Did you hear the thing about in healthcare that you have to work for your health care if you're from an inner city environment, but if you're from the suburbs, and it's all free, you know.
You know, they want to start drug testing too for people on any type of federal assistance. And Florida tried that a few years ago, and it wound up costing them a fortune because the person applying had to pay for the test, and if they were clean, the state had to reimburse them for the cost of the test. And they found out that less than 2% of the people failed the test, so cost Florida a lot more money to test these people than it was worth.
Well, that makes me happy.
That makes me happy too. Good to know.
So, but the federal government evidently hasn't learned from that, and I saw in the news recently that they're considering drug testing people who are any kind of federal assistance.
Yeah. And the tribalism that we see now seems to be a big part of it. And we've always had that tendency, but we've always, I think, held to a vision of America as being that melting pot where people can get along, and sort of, as a generality, people have worked toward that over the years.
And I find myself yelling at the television a lot more now than I used to. This morning, or yesterday, whenever it was in the news, the new rule that the football people have come up with, and this is insane. And then I heard our fearless leader say, "Well, these people shouldn't be on the field. Maybe people who think like that shouldn't even be in
shouldn't
America.
Shouldn't be in the country.
Shouldn't be in the country.
Yeah, right." And then you had one club owner, I forget which club it was, who said, "Well, I'll pay the fines. These guys can do what they need to do."
And his approval ratings are going up. Real polls now have him in
the 40s. You're talking about Trump?
Yeah,
scary. And
a few things should be said about the national anthem itself. It's awful. It's unsingable. It's written by a racist.
It glorifies war.
It glorifies war.
At the time, Land of the Free and Home of the Brave were made, over 2 million people were in slavery.
There's even a verse, the third verse of that specifically condemned slaves who were siding with the British because the British were, for their own reasons, trying to, get help in their efforts to suppress this colony that got away from them.
It's like the full version of Deutschland über alles.
Yeah, it's an ugly song, and there are many preferable anthems. And why should sporting events be started with the national anthem every time?
I was thinking this morning, wasn't there a time during the 60s when there was so much protesting going on that baseball games and sporting events actually stopped playing the national anthem?
I sure don't remember when they played that often back then.
I didn't pay that much attention to sports in those days. But there was a lot of flag burning, for sure. So it seems like there's a lot of racism and prejudice that's really underground. And I find, like for myself, I'm what you call a fat person. But when I see another person, maybe not any heavier than me, I find automatically I come up with these judgments about how they are. And I just wonder about, some of these things are so deeply hardwired into us. And I know from my own experience that those judgments don't necessarily apply, but they just pop out into my brain before I even have a chance to think about it. And that's the part that's really scary to me. What do we do about that?
Well, but you know, what were you talking about there, Lee, is stereotypes that we carry, okay? It, the problem here is that if we're only dealing with stereotypes and we're only dealing with how we interact with people on a one-to-one level, okay, and how that's colored by our stereotypes, we would not be in the mess we're in. Because, you know, racism is not, it's not an interpersonal event. It is a structural event, okay? We see now, as I was saying earlier, that there's like a 20-point difference between middle-class black and middle-class white students taking the same standardized test. we know this. This is not new. This has been going on for year after year after year. But what that does is it allows classrooms to be segregated even if the school itself is integrated. And we find that schools overall are journeying back to segregation through the acts of the district. When a school is 80% black and brown in a white city like San Francisco, that means you had to bring the black people over to this one place to go to school, you know? And, you know, when you look at police brutality, these are acts of an institution. This is not just one person being bad to another person.
It's cultural.
It's all about an institutional model of behavior that is being continued. So, you know, with the things like the stereotypes you're talking about, mm-hmm. there is actually ways that we can sit and work through those things with each other. This is not the most difficult thing in the world for us to stay in the same room together and keep talking about things that we have misunderstandings about with each other. But when you know, like for women, for instance, the rate of pay is 20 cents or so less per dollar that a man doing the same job is paid. That's not about I like you or I don't like you. It's about whether or not I can provide for myself.
But doesn't it begin with awareness?
I think it does begin with awareness, except, you know, one of the things we're finding now in the Trump era is, I was reading an article, I can't recall the man's name, is a very learned black scholar who's won like Pulitzer Prize for news writing. And he said, you know, we think somehow now that we're going to be able to understand each other into getting along and ending racism and so forth. He says, the pro-Trump folks that are into the Make America White Again, they are terrified of the fact that this country is changing. It is changing. The racial
really
makeup of this country is changing. And he says, you can't change those numbers. And folks are in the Trump administration and their buddies and all those folks, they want to do something to be able to be like South Africa, you know, to be in a country that's majority black and brown, but they still want to be able to be the ones holding all the power.
Out of control.
So
I live much of my life in California and find Oregon quite different.
Especially from Berkeley.
Especially from Berkeley and Oakland. But there are things that have happened in California that are really positive, and I kind of, again, had a personal experience of this. I used to work for a California politician named March Fong Yu, who when I worked for her, was an assemblywoman from Oakland and Castro Valley. She was one of only three women in the legislature of 120 at the time. She was one of only three Asians. Well, she recently died in her 90s. I went to the funeral, and I went for the kind of normal reasons people go to funerals, to pay respect to someone you admired and worked for. But also I thought I'd see some colleagues and staff people I hadn't seen for 30 years or so, and indeed I did. But there were three people who were statewide office. Oh, March was the first Asian woman in the whole country ever to be elected to a statewide constitutional office. And anyway, there were three statewide constitutional officers from California. And all three of them came from minority backgrounds. All three of them did not have English spoken in their home when they were growing up. But all three of them pursued the American dream, got good education, figured out how to work in politics, as indeed my old boss did. And to think that three of about seven California elected officials came from that kind of background is remarkable progress, I think.
I was really taken by Bill de Blasio talking about how New York has become one of the safest cities in the nation, as opposed to how it was a few years back. And the main reason, according to what I understood of what he was saying, is that they have taught the police de-escalation, mm-hmm. how to approach people and reduce that polarity and create the understanding, and that the police get to initiate that instead of, you know, it's my way or the highway, buddy.
They're also changing their marijuana policies.
They haven't done it yet, but I think it's coming.
The police in New York don't respond to demonstrations with tanks and APCs and all the things that we've seen in some of the Western states that actually set up an adversarial situation. Years ago during the pipeline in Alaska, there was a part of Fairbanks, there was a street called Two Street. It's Second Avenue, but we call it the Two Street. It had all the sleazy bars. And during the pipeline, the pipeliners would come into town literally with thousands of dollars in their pocket, when thousands of dollars was a lot of money. It was full of all kinds of vice and different things. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, the bars would close. Well, the police would show up en masse for the bar closings, and every night they would get in fights. And then one night, somebody decided, well, what if we just don't show up? And they didn't show up, and the bars closed, and everybody just went home. So there's different ways of handling police situations, and showing up with tanks, all of a sudden, you look like it's a war, and the other side will react like it's a war.
Yeah.
And what's so ugly about...
And, of course, Trump is giving tanks again to the police.
What's been so ugly about the incidents that have come to the fore in the last few years is they're over such trivial items. Mm-hmm. Skittles, a person
coffee
selling cigarettes by a single cigarette,
why,
is choked to death.
Why is that an arrestable offense? That should be a ticket.
I don't understand that.
That should be a violation. Not something where you arrest somebody.
And, well, right?
You know, when I was an attorney, I had to sue both the city and the county police departments in Louisville, Jefferson County, because they refused to enforce protective orders that they were legally required to enforce. So if somebody's going to somebody's house, they have a restraining order, and they're breaking in the door, and they're trying to hurt somebody, the police must arrest, whether or not there is a felony or what, no matter. However, you know, you would find people getting arrested. It was okay to arrest people for shoplifting. That was a statute. And the thing is, you know, it's usually difficult to get police to come in and just arrest folks on very slight grounds. But in these racial situations, you arrest a man for selling cigarettes outside of a package, and then if they try to move away from you, you shoot them, you choke them. It is extrajudicial execution.
And people say, well, it's because they're scared for their life. But, I mean, what really is going on in a person who would choose to do something like that?
You could be afraid if you're... quite a few years ago, there was a situation in New York where two police officers chased somebody down and fired a whole bunch of shots, and there was a big deal made out of it. And
he
they
was
were
African.
Actually,
Diallo. He was an African.
Yeah. They were acquitted in trial, and New York isn't... South Carolina or something. It's a much more fair-minded place. It turned out that he had something in his hand. I think, I don't know if it was a wallet or what it was.
Yeah, something
and
like that.
And this was in New York City, and there were a lot of people with guns, and they were somewhat justified to shoot him. Maybe the amount of times they shot him was indicated, but it was... There's things on the police side as well.
But as an attorney, I don't understand why it is, as you were saying, Ray, you try and arrest somebody for selling cigarettes. You know, this is ludicrous. And then why is it that you have to shoot somebody if they resist arrest?
You don't.
You don't have to shoot somebody because they resist arrest.
Yeah. Especially if the...
There's no danger.
If the arrest is not for a Class A felony.
Right.
There was an incident a couple of weeks ago of some guy was jaywalking, and a police car pulled up to him and gave him all kinds of problems. And it turned out this guy probably had some mental problems or was drinking or something, because he didn't quite react normally. But he wound up getting thrown on the ground and tased and arrested and everything. And this apparently took place late at night, because the film showed no cars on the road. It wasn't like he was crossing 42nd Street or something in New York. And he was, you know, a simple, hey, buddy, you should cross at the corner, should have handled that. But for some reason or other, it became incredibly escalated. I don't understand.
And
this
see,
at
that's
all.
Why I say that's where I feel like, you know, it's more of a setting a mark. Like, they want to let people know what they can do because they got the power to do it.
That explains.
Or at least they feel like they got the power to do it. But what makes them any different from us? But, you know, just because they got a badge, you know, they signed up to have that badge to protect us, because.
not merely just our own selves, because we are our own worst enemy before we make anybody else our enemy, you know. And that's why I say, like, I feel like we didn't get so caught up into trying to make ourselves known and want to make a name for ourselves to the point we don't care what we have to do it, you know. Just like now, like, you got officers that can easily shoot somebody down and see it on camera, and you send them to court, oh, nothing happened. Oh, well, give them a slap on the back, only just going to suspend them for a couple of days, but we ain't going to let nobody know, but bring them back on the low. We're going to just boost them down a little bit where we can make it believe that we done something about it. No, it's time for justice. Like, when you do wrong, you're supposed to get your consequence. It's no different.
Exactly.
It's no different. You know?
On a brighter note, I read a news article this morning that I can't remember his name, but the guy that shot the kid with candy, the neighborhood watch guy,
Zimmerman.
Okay. Yeah, he's in court right now, and he has to get a public defender because he's not only broke, he's $2 million in debt. And then shortly afterward, he was getting all kinds of money from the NRA and all kinds of people, and actually acquired quite a bit of money, but he's not. How can you get $2.5 million in debt? But he is.
Wow.
Well, listening to y'all,
time wounds all heals, maybe.
Yeah. And thinking about these situations where, you know, somebody gets choked out to death because, you know, they tried to buy a Lucy or something. I think that there must be a kind of a feeling with the person, the police that's doing that, that they have to dominate, that they have to have control no matter what, that if they lose this one little battle, they've lost the war. You see what I'm saying?
I used to tell people all the time, as because I was part of the union, if cops got in trouble, I was part of their initial defense team at least, it's okay to let the guy go. You don't have to make that arrest. You know, think of all that could happen here. We had an incident where we had a guy way off in a rural area chase somebody into the woods, and it was very cold out, and when he caught up with the guy beat him up, and the guy killed him, choked him to death. Another incident where somebody chased a car down, the car stopped, and he chased them into the woods, and there was a shooting took place. The cop gun went off and the guy was dead, and there were only two people there, and one of them was dead, and the cop was found at fault. I always tell people, people reach in the car to turn off the key when somebody won't turn the key off. We were taught in the academy, never, never, never reach inside the car.
Because
you'd be dragged. Yeah, it's a stupid thing to do. And it's okay. If the guy drives away, he drives away. That's a lot smarter than you being dead or being drugged or getting in all kinds of trouble. There's just a little bit of reasonableness.
Yeah, and certainly there's some great cops, too. I mean, I remember being in Venice, California, and they were doing community policing, and the cops were just wonderful. I mean, they were so helpful. I'm sure if you were up to no good, they would have another side to show, you know. But it was a completely different feeling from other situations I've been in where, you know, you're guilty until proven okay.
So somebody mentioned before de-escalating. I don't remember 5 minutes in the academy of being taught how to de-escalate situations. And one of the problems we would have now and then would be with people who had mental problems. And people with mental problems are not always dangerous. In fact, they rarely are. Right. But it can be a challenging thing for a cop to deal with if he doesn't know anything about it and he just thinks the person is strange. At the time, I had a friend who taught a course in police officers dealing with people with mental problems. So I went to my boss, and he says, oh, nobody will want to do that. And I said, well, put out a memo. And he put out a memo, and he was right. Nobody signed up to take that course. It just seemed like such a fundamental thing to me, but nobody was interested in
learning. There's a lot of...
Because I can say, you know, in life, you know, before you can understand something, you got to be willing to learn it first. Yeah. That's like going to school. You can go to school all day. Doesn't mean you're going to learn anything.
Right.
You got to be willing to learn what you're going to school for, so you can have a better understanding of it. You know, that's like us being humans, us being people, getting along with each other. We don't take the time out of our day to even learn each other. That's why we don't care about each other. That's why we're not here for each other, because we don't take the time to even learn each other. You know, we sit up and just be so quick to just opinionate each other instead of taking the time to learn each other and learning our ways. You know, because, like I said, it's more of like, you know, an opinionation of a setting an example. You know, back then, like, they used to say, you know, African-Americans, we didn't know how to read and write, all of that. We had to learn it. We had to learn how to develop these. When you say that's what we have to, in order for us to be able to, you know, get along and make this place better, we have to learn how to understand each other. Because understanding go by far. It go by far. You can understand a lot of things in so many different ways to the point that same one way finally come to one point. But who's to know? Not unless you're willing to learn and understand how far it goes.
And in addition to understanding, there are other really specific things that are not that hard to learn, like nonviolent communication, which is a great de-escalator of any situation. That's where it came from, with conflict resolution work. And anybody can pick up a $14 book and learn that in a couple of weeks.
What's extraordinary about the civil rights movement is so much changed by nonviolent direct action by some very, very bold people.
Yeah. Can you say more about that? We were talking about de-escalation, and it just really fits with what
many of the people involved in the civil rights movement, especially in the South in its early days, were very, very disciplined in being willing to accept violence, mm-hmm. being willing to not respond violently to violence, to be organized to get specific goals that they wanted to accomplish and doing what was necessary to get those goals. They learned a lot from Gandhi and mm-hmm. what happened in India.
Assault march and all that.
Assault march and all that. And part of what is so extraordinary is if they hadn't had that commitment to nonviolence, there could have been enormous bloodshed throughout the South, throughout the country. And the idea that only the South was a major area of racism wasn't true. I had some experience in Indiana, too. I happened to go to school there for a while in the early 60s, and some Southern governors like Ross Barnett of Mississippi and George Wallace of Alabama were coming to town to get Northern support in a very conservative town. And boy, I experienced real extreme racism in just by leading a demonstration and showing up on TV and happened to be in a bar. And pretty soon it got a very hostile scene in the bar, and they signaled stuff to the bartender, and I was wondering what was going on. And what they did was get out a photograph of a lynching that had taken place 8 miles from there back in the 30s, and made it very specific that we thought we should learn from what happened where in that neighborhood nearby where they didn't have any problems anymore. And so racism was strong throughout the country, mm-hmm. and it still is, and it's strong here.
But there's been a huge change in attitude about types of people who are different than the mainstream. Uh-huh. I was at La Rosa's house the other day. She had a little party, and I happened to bring up the idea of the Monty Python Lumberjack song. Is everybody familiar with that?
No.
Where the lumberjack dresses up in panties and a bra and hangs out in bars. It's not funny anymore. So what?
Yeah. I was like, Gwen, what's your point? Well, I've been called out even here in our Little River City, having dinner in one of the sushi bars, and said something about immigration, and this fellow, I mean, he took off on me. He would have hit me if we were alone, I'm pretty sure. It was downright scary. Really drew a lot of attention from everybody else in the restaurant, and it was quite something. So it's, you know, still alive and well in Brookings.
I can do a little plug for my show, What's Going On.
Uh-huh.
Last week I recorded a show and I played a song by Cheech and Chong called Born in East L.A.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. Is everybody familiar with that?
Yeah.
Cheech comes out of the store and he's confronted by a Border Patrol agent who doesn't believe he was born in East L.A. And he winds up back in Mexico where he'd never been and has to sneak back into the country back to East L.A. And I played it. It's a joke song. And now this past week, I think it was Montana, two women were picked up and held by the Border Patrol because they were speaking Spanish. Yes. And it turned out they were both born in Texas.
Wow.
But, of course, they didn't have green cards, just like Cheech didn't.
Now, in Canada, they put French on all the street signs, even though most of the French are out in Quebec, which is, you know, 2,000 miles away from BC, where I lived. Even the labels on the milk cartons and everything are in French. It's a really different attitude to embrace other cultures. Mm-hmm. We're getting towards the end of our hour. I want to make sure everybody has a chance to fill in any last thoughts they might have.
One of the things I would like to say is that I think it's really extremely important that people be engaged in anti-racist work. It's good for us to talk with each other. It's good for us to try and understand each other's situations and, you know, to become more connected and aware of each other. But it's also really important that we do direct actions. We do things like, you know, economic boycotts of businesses that are not treating their employees in ways that are racially equal. There's many, many different things that we can do. One of the most important ones, of course, being vote in 2018.
And we should maybe fold some of that in, too. If you have organizations that you would recommend to anybody who'd like to learn more or get involved, please do fold that in here as well. It's always nice to be able to give people resources.
Well, I'm the chair of Curry County Democrats, and we're working very hard to make this a more welcoming city. Though there are some ways that it's definitely not. So we also have the Progressives in Curry County, meets every second Saturday of the month at Blue Waters Cafe. And either one of those organizations, Indivisible, they're a good springboard for going off and being engaged, phoning your legislators, writing letters, showing up at events to tell legislators whether or not you agree with their policies. We need to do the work.
Mm-hmm. And what about national organizations? ACLU, of course. Anybody else come to mind that you'd recommend?
One thing that we recently had the 50th anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King, and one thing that came out of that is the National Council of Churches, which represents something like 32 million Christians, generally of the mainstream and Orthodox sort, not the evangelical sort. But they, in connection with King's death's anniversary, had a big rally in the National Mall in Washington by King's statue, and are saying to their own members that if Christianity lives up to its calling, that they could do enormous things to combat racism in all the forms that it takes in our society. Now, it sounds great, but and I've personally been one who, throughout my life, trying to enlighten white Christians, basically, on these kind of issues. But we'll see if this is just rhetoric or that they seriously are going to try and challenge within their churches the type of racism that's in our society.
Well, it seems to me like the only way that we can really deal with the polarity that's being encouraged now, the polarization, is to encourage the opposite, the unity between people. And anything we do along those lines is going to be a big help. So we're about ready to wrap things up. Any last thoughts? Let's go around and just say our names once again. I'm Lee.
My name is Ray. I'm the host of What's Going On, a radio show here on KCIW Radio in Brookings. And you will listen to my show. You'll learn lots of things. We play insightful protest and meaningful music.
And I'm LaRose Felicity. I am chair of Curry County Democrats and glad to participate in this discussion of how to deinstitutionalize racism in our country.
I'm Bob O'Sullivan. I love this area, but I wish it were more open and accepting and diverse.
And I'm Gerald Harris, and I'm in Oregon, and I love it. It's a beautiful place. It just, hey, everywhere needs to be picked up. Everybody need a helping hand. You know, it's time to reach out and lift everybody up like we're supposed to. Be more aware.
And so thank you all for coming, and thank you all for listening. This has been Discussions at Brookings Cafe on KCIW 100.7. Thanks.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.